Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles.
So today we're going to finish this thing with David and Jacob, and then we'll wrap it up. All right. Now, I'm not going to review everything else, but here we're now moving into some different areas. And a lot of these do not require you flipping through books, but there are things you will recall and you'll be able to understand from your broad background and based upon what we've already looked at what I'm talking about. Okay. So, both Jacob and David lived in foreign nations who at different times were enemies of the Israelites and who conquered areas of Israel during the biblical period. And both of them returned to Canaan and are stronger than they were when they left. Okay, so Jacob, where does he live outside of Eretz Yisrael?
He goes to his uncle.
Right?
Laban. And Haran. Was it Haran?
Yeah, Laban, right. Aram. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then he comes back a rich man, right? Loaded with sheep. And then at the end of his life, where does he die?
In Egypt. With the request that his bones be brought back when they
right.
go back.
And they are. We know that. So, and both of those countries, at different points in time, controlled areas of Canaan. And that is a historical fact. Okay?
Was Canaan actually a country, or was it just
a
region?
Geographically.
It was the name of a region.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, the Bible refers to Canaan.
Right.
Because when Jacob comes into the land, you know, when he leaves and returns, it's not Eretz Yisrael yet.
Right.
Okay.
But I mean, it's not like there were borders with border control.
No.
Didn't need a passport.
No.
Or a visa.
In David's day, of course, it was a country. More or less. Yeah. And Saul and Solomon ruled over the United Kingdom, so to speak. But of course then it split. Okay. David, in what foreign country did he live?
When he fled and lived in the cave with the spiders, I'm blocking on the name.
That was the journey, yes.
But when he needed to flee from Saul, did he go to the Philistines? He went somewhere surprising.
Yes, twice. Twice he went to the Philistines. Exactly. And each time he came back and was stronger, ultimately, than he was before. Okay, and of course, we know the Philistines, they controlled substantial areas of Canaan from about 1150 to the time of David in 1000 for about 150 years. And the Egyptians controlled areas there. Well, it depends how far back you want to go, but they controlled areas there from 1400 BCE down to the Philistines, and then they would come back and conquer areas from the Philistines. They had an intrusion. There was an intrusion after Solomon died. Okay. Shoshank came in. They call him Sheshach in the Bible. But he left after that. So that was around 920. So, I mean, these countries, and of course, the Aram was a kingdom. They remained an independent kingdom outside of the land of Israel, but they controlled areas there from time to time. So that's a common feature. Okay, it's a common feature. Okay, Tybel.
And if I recall, because Goliath was from Gat, and isn't Gat in what we now call Gaza, of all things?
Gaza is Gaza. I mean, there were five. Yes, I mean, that's not just Gaza. It includes Ashdod, Ashkelon, Ekron, Gap, and Gaza. Okay, so the areas, the two harbors in Israel, originally were part of the Philistine land. All right. And the Philistines should not be confused with the Feldsteins or the Feinsteins. Okay, don't forget that. Now,
just a comment. You know, we're talking about history as we know it, but of course, people controlled the land for what, millions of years before then, or hundreds of thousands of years. We have no idea who it was.
Right. Of course. No. I mean, we can go back. I don't know. We know that when one of the conquests that the Egyptians made, I think we talked about this, Merneptah in 1210 BCE. Remember, he conquers the area and he says, Israel is no more. And it's not really the names of, there are a number of other locations that are on his stone where he records this, but they are towns. They're like city states. And Israel is not noted in that way. It's more of a land, an area of the people. It appears that he's talking about a group rather than a geographical site. So this is 1210, but that's, by the way, very interesting, because it's clear then from a non-biblical, non-Israelite source that there is something there called Israel in 1210. Okay? So we know that roots of the people who ended up growing and becoming Israel are already there. And that's pretty solid evidence. All right. Good evening. Good afternoon, Bobby. Good to see you. Okay. Moving on. God makes covenants with both of them in spite of their human failings. Now here, if you want, you can open up your Bible. Verses 12 to 22.
It's the famous Jacob's ladder story.
Yeah. But read 12 to 22. It's after that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And now, go to Shmuel Bet, 2 Samuel. There was another place. Oh, stop a second. Hold it. Stop. Whoop. Pause. Again, Jacob, just to show you something. Genesis 35, verses 9 to 15. This is again with Jacob, right? You got it. 35, 9 to 15. Okay. Now, what is a major, this is a real picky question, but there is a very significant difference between the two accounts. And I'll tell you, it doesn't have anything to do with people. There's a difference between the two accounts.
What happens with stones? Because one is a rock that's a pillow, which is a quotidian thing, and the other becomes something to worship God. Because there's a drink, both a drink offering and oil.
It's a matzevah in the second case.
Well, but the matzevah was done in the first case also.
But there's also, isn't one for the pillow? Let me go back to 28.
Yeah, okay. All right. Good. But I'm thinking of something even bigger than that.
The kings?
No. What?
The prophecy that they will be kings. In the first case, okay.
Wait. Kings from?
In 11. I'm sorry. In verse, I'm looking at 35, verse 11.
Okay. What's it say?
An assembly of nations shall descend from you. Kings shall issue from your loins. I think the first one didn't mention kings.
All right. Yeah. Good. Okay. That was one. That's an important one. Yes.
Particularly if you're David.
How about there are two parallels in 28 to Avraham which is the mention of Avraham and not Avram. And then 14, it's a restatement in a way of the covenant, because Avraham got as numerous as sand and stars. And this is another way to be numerous in 14. Thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth.
Right. Good. All right. These are all great. Excellent. I'm talking something bigger. Are you ready? What is God's name in chapter 28?
Tetragrammaton.
What?
Yudevave. And it's El Shaddai in 35.
It's called, it's what?
El Shaddai.
El Shaddai.
Chapter 35.
Right. Now, who uses El Shaddai? That's a P.
Right. But within Moses, God said before then.
It's used a number of places.
Yeah.
But that is a P source. Whereas the Genesis 28 is a J source. Okay? And we know that Elohim in 35 is J, because according to J, God's name was not known to the patriarchs and wasn't known until Egypt. With Moses, chapter 6 of Exodus, where God says, I was known to the ancestors as El Shaddai, but now my real name is going to be revealed, and that is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Right. So what this means is that in both traditions, both the J tradition and the P tradition, covenant is established with Jacob. That's the very, you know, that's, you know, it's a significant thing, because ultimately it is with Jacob that we begin to see the beginnings of the fulfillment of the promise of more people, because ends up having 12 sons. And as I said before, that is the root, the foundation of B'nai Yisrael.
And this is something where everyone agreed, is what you're saying. The J and the P and the North and the South.
Exactly, right.
Everybody could find common ground with that idea.
Exactly. So that shows you the common ground of the recognition of the broad base of the covenant. Okay. Regarding David now. 2 Samuel, Shmuel Beit. 2 Samuel. Chapter 7, basically the whole chapter. Just skim it over. 2 Samuel, not 1st, 2nd. 2 Samuel, chapter 7.
Is this the surprise where it sounds as if David's going to be allowed to build the temple, but then later he's not allowed because he did too much with iron and was warlike?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sort of. I mean, that plays itself out as the narrative develops. Okay? And all right, so here's the question. Do you know of a third covenant that God makes with somebody among the Israelites, another covenant? And I don't have the verses here because I should have. Well, it's not relevant to this, but just as an ancillary perspective. There's one other eternal covenant that God makes with an individual who is a significant player in the biblical traditions. Do you know that? Anybody take a guess?
Is it Noah?
No, that's everybody. That's universal.
Oh, so this is only for Jews?
Right, for Israelites.
But it's not Abraham?
They weren't called Jews yet. They weren't called Jews yet.
Right, Israel. But it's not Abraham?
No. Abraham's part, yeah. Abraham and David are part of the same. Abraham and Jacob are, by your own, you know, what you mentioned before, that's the same covenant.
Is it Josiah?
Nope.
Just because, you know, this class, Josiah is.
Nope.
Who has the covenant of the parts?
That's Abraham.
That's still all the same.
Anybody?
Moshe. Is it Moshe?
Nope. Moshe gets no covenant. Actually, he does a personal one, but not any kind of long term. Yes, when he comes down from the mountain the second time and his face is aglow, God says, I make a covenant with you and with the people. It's interesting. And he, and Moses comes first. So that's a very, people don't necessarily look at that carefully, but that implies that at that point, Moses had his own unique covenant with God as a person, but that was nothing dynastic about it. I just gave you a clue.
Then it's the Jewish people.
No.
A clue that didn't work yet.
That's the patriarchs. That's the Jewish people. Oh, the Jewish people is Sinai. Yeah, you're right. Okay, ha, 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 I got it. No, I don't mean that. I'm talking, I said an individual. I mean, Sinai is actually the fulfillment of the patriarchal covenant.
Do you mean Aharon in the priesthood?
Yes, yes, you did it again. Oh, slam dunk. Oh, you're going to go to the All-Star game. Okay, right, Aaron. Exactly. And it almost worked. Of course, the people who came in and screwed it up were the, first of all, the Greeks, but then, of course, the Hasmoneans came over and took over. But although they claimed to be from the line of Pinchas. Anyhow, no, but there was, the truth is, the dynasty of the priest Sadok, who came into power as high priest under David and continued under Solomon, his line continued to operate until the time of the Maccabean revolt, right, where basically Antiochus took the priesthood away from that family and gave it to Jason and then to Menelaus. And then ultimately the Maccabees took it over. And as I say, they claim to be from the line of Pinchas, which predates Tzadok. Tzadok was a descendant of Pinchas. Okay. And remember, Pinchas is already in the Torah. That's Aaron's grandson. So, but the fact is that that line continued to have its adherents because there is a group of people who arise around 150 BCE that bear the name of that dynasty. Who are those? Who appears on the scene in Eretz Israel around 150 BCE, and their name is associated with the line of the dynasty of Tzadok?
Is that the Sadducees?
It is the Sadducees. And they were not very sad, you see, until they had their power taken away by the Pharisees, because they were the ones who knew what was fair. That's pretty good.
Was that impromptu?
Yes. Well, right, just now.
Wow. All right.
Wondering, always wondering how to remember that.
All right. Yes. Anyhow, yeah. So, and the Tzedukim are already, is continued to be a thorn in the side of the rabbis into this first and second centuries. Eventually, they, in the, given the absence of a temple, their whole thing fizzled. And priestly adherents became part of the Pharisees. There were first and second generation sages among the Tanaim, you know, period of the Mishnah, who were Rabbi Tarfon, for example, was a priest, and he was known. Tarfon is around 100, and he was known CE. I'm talking CE, and he was known for his knowledge and experience during temple times. Okay. Anyway, so that's, but the Aaronid priesthood, according to Torah, was that, you know, the dynasty that comes out of Aaron. All right. So you learn something new. Okay. And of course, the whole notion of the dynastic, aspect of the Davidic line continues to operate as an ideal principle down into the days of the prophets. I mean, obviously, one of the clearest expressions of that is in Isaiah, when he talks about the Tzemach, that where, you know, a shoot will come out of the root of Jesse. And that will be the line of kings, you know, or it is from that line it will follow. And presumably the king Hezekiah, who was the righteous king at the time of Isaiah, he was in that line. Whether this is referring to him and his descendants, we don't know. But that develops, that presence in Isaiah opens the door to the whole notion that this dynasty will ultimately become the ruling person in Eretz Yisrael at the end of days. I think Hezekiah may have hoped at one time that Isaiah, because this is Isaiah chapters 10 and 11. It's first Isaiah. We're talking around 720, 700 BCE. He's already hoping that this is imminent. You know, he's hoping. And of course it wasn't. It wasn't to be. But that's where the line of the significance of that continues. Now, granted, it was presumably, traditionally, it was at work, it was operative during the split, from Solomon, but also during the split monarchy. But this is future oriented, and that line that continues to be passed down until today. Okay. All right, Tybel.
Couldn't one argue that the power of that notion can be seen in that sect from that time that eventually split away and became a new religion, supersession and all, and that is why violating every genealogical principle, a big genealogical principle in the New Testament, there's a derivation of Jesus Christ from King David.
Right.
I mean, that's the power. I understand it's not Jewish. Well,
yeah, of course.
The original Jewish sect, but that's the power, even though I don't think it speaks to people in quite the same way today, but that was the power of the notion at the time.
Yeah, but not only then, if I may extend on what you're saying, it's absolutely correct. You can trace during the course of throughout centuries, messianic-like figures that pop up at different points in time. There's a whole book on that, the messianic idea in Israel. And generationally, this pops up over and over, and we have it right now in our midst, right? Actively, right now. I told you, I saw it on the streets.
Do the Rebbe's followers, the one who thinks he didn't die with the ohel, do they think he's from Davidic line, or it doesn't matter?
Yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely. Sure. Yep. All right. Anyhow, yes. Yeah, so that is indeed the case. Yes, indeed. All right. So it starts there. Moving on. Who would you say was Jacob's favorite wife?
Abigail.
No, Jacob?
I thought you were... Oh, Jacob, I'm sorry. I was so ready for David. Oh, God.
Rachel.
Does it have to be Rachel?
Rachel.
And at the end of the day, who ends up being David's favorite wife?
I think it's Abigail, not Bathsheba.
It's Bathsheba.
It was Bathsheba because it was her son. Remember at the end? Okay. Now, Abigail is, yes, there was a relationship there, and that was very much politically driven, I would say.
Yeah, but he listened to her as a person. She wasn't just someone to be in
the
bedroom.
That's fine. That's fine. And you look, I mean, Michal yelled at him, and he didn't listen to her. All right. Yes, I understand that. But ultimately, it is her. If you read Chronicles, you don't have a listing out of the descendants of Abigail completely, if there were any. But you have from Bathsheba, her descendants are laid out. So in other words, Bathsheba ultimately comes to be seen as the principal wife because it is through her that the Davidic dynasty was continued. And of course, ultimately, it is the child of both of those women who become the leading force in the next generation, right? Rachel's son, okay, being, Joseph, et cetera, right? Joseph, that's Ephraim comes out of Joseph. And that ultimately was the root of the northern kingdom. And then, of course, from Bathsheba comes Solomon. And need I say anything else? So they both happen to have wives whose children are the next, are the foundation of the continuity of the family line. Okay. And that's not, again, this is all part of a whole structure of analogous details that are interestingly present in the biographies of these two men. Yes, Tybel.
But on the one hand, I mean, it's not that there aren't all those commonalities, but if someone's going to have descendants, it has to be carried through someone.
Yes.
So I'm not following why, unless is the point that the descendants that went on to make a difference were through the favorite wife. Is that the commonality?
No, I'm saying is at the end of the day, Solomon made a decision, right? David made decisions during his life before he died, right? I mean, look, the truth is, yes, Bathsheba sort of disappears from the scene, right? And other things happen in the aftermath. But on the other hand, she reappears at the critical moment. And there's no question that his attraction to her was very powerful. Or her attraction to, sorry. Her, David was attracted to her because of her beauty. Politics, relationships with other people in the court, et cetera, you know, with Saul, family, et cetera, became irrelevant. And one has the sense he promised her at the outset that her kids are going to get it. And in the end, when the time comes, she comes forward and says he made a promise, and he does not say, no, that was canceled, right? He affirms it. So his commitment to her still seems to have been present. I can't argue about where she, we just don't know about her because all of these other intrigue-related, you know, associations as part of the royal history are more interesting to the historian than what happened, you know, in the interim to Bathsheba. But in the end, Bathsheba carries the day, and his feelings for her are there. Okay, that's my point. Okay? And again, that's a parallel. Bert?
Okay, so I hear all this, and I understand all this, and I keep on trying to figure out, did it really happen this way by coincidence? Did it happen this way because...
After that last week.
Well,
was part of a very complicated answer. Right?
Okay.
The answer is...
I'm a simple man.
I know. But life is complicated. All right? And the Bible is best proof of that. No, again, we don't know for sure. There are three options. One, that the Jacob stories were in place and the life of David was recrafted to conform to that and somehow in a way to polish David's statue, so to speak, because he was a problematic king, powerful, right, important, influential, but a problematic person. And so they wanted to say he wasn't the first. We tolerated Jacob. We tolerate David.
So he kind of controlled the social media.
Wait, yes, that's one. The other one is that the Davidic stories were real. And in order to accomplish this, they rewrote elements of the Jacob stories to make the Jacob stories more consistent with David. Or the third is, which I tend to believe, is all of this was going on at the same time. In other words, that the historical roots, that it's in the tenth century, between 1000, sometime after David or during David, even royal history was being written. Okay, and at that time already, clear that there were issues with David that needed to be responded to, because the reality was he was a rough king, and he was a man who dug holes for himself, had to come out of them, killed people, violated law, right, morality, etc., and got it back, you know, and he was hit over and over again with incidents that, and that proves that some of this may have been crafted as part of the history there to say that David got punished for all the things that he did wrong. And ultimately, the point is you could say the same about Jacob. But at the same time, you can say that in that period, the stories of Jacob that had been passed down orally were now being compiled and organized, because the early roots of these biblical, of the Torah sources, written down Torah sources, seem to appear around that time. Okay, so that may have been simultaneously. Okay, you know, I don't know. But clearly, Jacob, of all the patriarchs, was the one whose family engagement was the most fully developed, just in terms of the volume of material that deals with him,
right,
until his dying day.
Most of Genesis.
Right. And remember, Abraham, when Abraham dies at age 175, he said he lived a wonderful life, right? He looked great when he died, and he was happy, blah, blah, blah. He had remarried to Keturah, had a whole bunch of new kids, and he's living the life of Riley. Okay?
A Rylovitz.
Yes. And yet when, ironically, right, when David dies, it's the exact opposite. He just experienced a revolt from Absalom, right? And now there's turmoil over who's going to take over, right? And both of them, we talked about this, you know, they're the two of the people who really bless their descendants, or bless or curse. And both of them had some harsh words to say to their descendants as to what to do or what's going to happen, right? So, I mean, it was a natural, and it may be that the stories naturally coalesced, and somebody said, let's really work on this, because it's important to preserve in some way the credibility of King David. Could have happened after Solomon when the country split, right? Can you imagine you're a Judahite, right? You're living in Judah. Jerusalem's your capital. And suddenly your country that was united is torn apart by those goddamn guys, pardon my French, in the north. Okay? And you get, there's anger and there's frustration and so forth. That may have been nobody's written on this. I haven't seen anything. Shouldn't say nobody's written. But, you know, that's a trauma. Yes? It's a trauma. Now, it may be, you could argue, this was a natural split, because in point of fact, there are great cultural differences between the North and the South. And there are, simply based on economy, right? Based upon your natural surroundings. The South is basically barren. The North has got a lot of fertile land. So from an agricultural perspective, it's a whole different notion. And your relationship to nature and the world is different. Yes? I mean, this is a fact. You've lived in, some of you have been there. You know what I'm talking about. Okay, you don't see a lot of terracing in the North. In the South, it's part of the normal structure in areas of Judah. So, I mean, the whole point is that we don't know, okay? But the point of this is, clearly, I would say nobody would disagree that ultimately there was felt need to have some kind of a cleansing of the image of David. I think, and whether that happened while he was alive, after he died, you know, okay, so the making of this link becomes an important element in that. So I think that's what we have to just keep in mind. But as to what came first, the chicken or the egg, it's hard to know.
Would a traditionalist have the same approach that you were
talking
about? Or they would just say God was behind it, and
God ultimately, you know, it's a rabbinic acceptance of an oxymoron. Hakol safui v'harishut netuna, right? Pirkei Avot, all is foreseen, but free will is given, right? God knows everything in advance, but you still have free will. And that's true. And that's the truth. It's like the Bible runs on two levels simultaneously. Okay, you got an elevated and you got a subway, just like Berlin. And sometimes they end up taking different routes, but they always end up at the same central station. Well, that's a good analogy. All right, and that's the way the Bible operates.
Would the traditionally, would they have the sense that God was behind all of these events?
Ultimately, in the sense that the end result is going to be the same. But because God gave free will, the human beings are going to work it out in their own human way. Whereas the master plan God saw, and ultimately they're going to have to, but God knows. That, again, I repeat, Rambam says don't try to understand this. Because you'll never understand what it means to have divine knowledge. You cannot know that and what that means. Just assume you got free will and live a responsible life. That's what Rambam ends up saying, okay, multiple times. Basically, he's right. He hit the nail on the head on that one. You know. Anyhow, but I think that's what you got to keep in mind. You're dealing with great inconsistencies here, or let's say with great multiple levels of existence.
But there, as you point out, there is a very interesting parallel. For whatever reason, it's there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, look, the prophets are already prophesying the destruction of Jerusalem, you know, decades before it happened, right? And it happened. And that's one of the points, by the way, that fixed this notion of ultimate divine control over history into the program, because they said it was going to happen and it happened. Okay. And then but the rabbis end prophecy. We talked about that. They end prophecy because it ceased from being a helpful means of running a religious society. Tybalt.
So for my ultimate namesake, I feel the need to make this point that sometimes prophesize about something that does not in fact come to fruition, but it doesn't mean the prophets were wrong. It meant that somebody listened and it was averted. So,
yeah.
So the fact that whoever was heading down a path and a prophet would say this will lead to the destruction of Jerusalem decades before might just mean that all along people listen. And I say that, of course, for Jonah, who was like, I don't want to do this. They're not going to listen to me anyway.
And lo and behold, they did. All right. Yes. No, exactly. Yeah, that's true. I mean, Isaiah thought that the destruction was going to happen during his day. Okay. And he was wrong. And that's a known, you know, that's not my idea. You read the book, you read the commentators on it. Okay.
I'd say Isaiah wasn't wrong. I'd say Isaiah saw potentialities, and because Isaiah was speaking as strongly as he was, it was averted for the time.
Yeah, but that makes it, but still it's He mouthed ideas and notions that did not come into fruition. Nobody doubts his greatness as a prophet. And nobody doubts that the principles that he stood for were valid and powerful principles. Okay, and that really qualifies him as a prophet. Okay, because no prophet, you're right, no prophet is assumed to be able to control all the details of the future. Nobody. Okay. I mean, yeah, sure, Moses talked about all the horrible things that were happening to the people. But you'd think, you know, look at the curses in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy. They're horrible things. And this is what's going to happen if you don't follow the covenant. But then how do you explain that between his death and the fall of the northern kingdom that went on up there with David and Solomon, and their idolatrous, their acceptance of, you know, their permissiveness of regarding idolatry, all the kings in the north and the south, nothing happens to all those predictions in the Torah until finally the Assyrians come down. Okay? And, you know, so how long do you have to wait? Well, centuries. And that's why I think that's one of the reasons why you read in the Torah, Hashem, Hashem, El Rachum Buchanun. He's a very compassionate God. He's willing to forgive. I'll give him another chance. I'll give him another chance. Give him another chance. I'll warn them. I'll warn them, you know, and finally says, I give up, and boom. And then it continues afterwards, even the stubbornness of this crazy people continues after the destruction of the North. And it, you know, and Jeremiah starts yelling and yelling, and throw him in jail for a while, you know, what's with this people? And finally, God says, enough, boom, and out comes Nebuchadnezzar. So the point is, you know, this notion of the immediacy of prophecy also, it doesn't necessarily fit with everything. So I'm saying that Isaiah falls into that a little bit, but it doesn't diminish the power of his prophetic, you know, statements in terms of understanding of how the dynamic between God and the people operates. In the end, he was right. Just his timing was off a little bit, that's all. Because he's a human being. You can't deny the human factor in all of this. And that's the issue, right? That's always the issue. Remember, who is God's the thorn in his side? All right? Us. Ta-da! All right. Moving on. Now, I know I didn't answer your question, Bert. It's the best I can do. And anybody who says they can, let me know.
No. I'm just trying to understand, you know, some of the whys of this, but you're absolutely correct on one thing. It is complicated.
Yes.
It is complicated. And I think that's wonderful, because if it wasn't complicated, we would have stopped studying it
right.
a thousand years ago.
Look at how many books are written. Read, compare the length in verbiage of the Tosafot to that of the Talmud. Okay? All right? And the other interpreters of the Talmud. Look at the back of the book of a traditional volume of Talmud. All those commentaries in such tiny print, trying to figure out what these rabbis were talking about.
And look at Talmud versus, you know, Torah.
Right,
the
there too.
The Talmud is...
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, yes. All right. Moving on. All right, now here, this is, you know, what I'm about to say seems so obvious, but you shouldn't overlook it. Both David and Jacob have dysfunctional families with fatal or near fatal sibling rivalries, right? Joseph's brothers plot to kill Joseph, yes. And Absalom ultimately has his servants kill Amnon for the rape of his sister, right? And it keeps percolating. And even at the very end of his life, here, instead of there being a clear understanding of who's the heir to the throne, you know, one of his other sons says, it's me. Hello, I'm the new king. And they begin to celebrate. And finally, Nathan comes and says, hey, Dave, you blew it. You promised, you know, Bathsheba, wake up. Okay. And so forth. And Nathan probably understood, you know, what would happen afterwards because of this intrigue. It turns out Solomon was a, you know, at one level, a powerful unifier, but on the other level, he raised the hackles of a lot of people. When he died, the people in Jerusalem, we are told, they were not so unhappy because the amount of taxes that he leveled on them and the amount of people that he recruited to build his beautiful buildings, it made everybody very angry. Okay, so there's dysfunctionality in both families. And I always tell people, you know, when I give sermons on this, look at what the patriarchs and matriarchs did. Learn from their mistakes. Don't do those things. And the major problem was what preferential treatment of one sibling over others. Think about it. Okay? With Jacob and Esau, right? Each member, each spouse had a different favorite. With Joseph, why didn't Jacob learn from his own mistakes? Seeing what happened. I'm sorry, Isaac's. I always make this. Hold on. Stop. Rebecca and Isaac. That's where it starts. Rebecca and Isaac. Okay? Favoritism. Right? Then that carries down with Jacob and Esau. Favoritism, right? And that carries down with Joseph. Favoritism, okay? And all along, same problem. Nobody learned. And that's part of the story. We think that people learn from the mistakes of the other past generations, and they don't. Same thing. Northern Kingdom falls. Well, why didn't the Southern Kingdom suddenly just clean up their act totally? Instead, what happens? King Manasseh comes in and makes the idolatry even more rampant. For 55 years, he rules. Nobody kicks him out. And the idolatry goes crazy to the point where even though Josiah comes to fix it up, the prophetess Huldah tells him it's too late. You can start the process, but it's not going to be finished because the sinfulness of the people is too deeply embedded. Well, why didn't they learn from the north? Okay, so the same thing, dysfunctional families continues down. Tybel.
I was trying to remember and I couldn't get there in the text, but I have this recollection, but it may be a modern thing that we don't actually know that King David promised Bathsheba. What we know is that Bathsheba came and told him that they had, and I think one thing I read said he was already had some kind of dementia or it was just easier to go along. So that which she boldly asserted became the truth. Is that correct or do we have it twice?
Nathan the prophet was the one who brought it to his attention.
Oh, all right. Thanks.
That's the answer. I mean, I haven't read back to see if that's it, but Nathan was the one who said that. And he's the only guy who's got the right ideas about everything. That was a prophet who was not so much, he was a prophet in a sense, but he had a profound understanding of what was going on in that household and in the country. Absolutely. The one thing he didn't recognize was the possibility that Solomon would be so lax with regard to idolatry. He himself, obviously, Solomon did not promote it, but he allowed it to continue and to grow because of all the alliances, presumably, that he made with pagan women. You know, pagan kings are in the area. You know, that's politics, right? But it had an underbelly to it, which was the spread of idolatry. Okay. All right. And yeah. Okay. We talked about this already, that the parallel between the fact that the kutonet pasim, right, the beautiful cloak that Joseph had, that concept, that term is only repeated elsewhere in the entire Bible with Tamar in Amnon and Tamar. So it's only in those two stories of people, those two households, that that garment appears nowhere else in the Bible. And that everybody noticed that right away, as far as I can see from my reading of the sources that analyze this. Okay? So keep that in mind. It's really, that's very, if you think of it, it's very interesting. Now, here's a very subtle one. There's a place on the map. There's a town, and I'll show you where it is. All right. All right. So here is, these are various, this is Jacob's return. The black, the I didn't mark it, that was on the map. That's Jacob's return from Haran, based upon what we can guess. All right. But look over here. See that? Wait a minute. Here. That's Jerusalem. Hold on. Here it is. Right here. See that? What's the name of the town? The long name?
Mahanaim.
Mahanaim. Mahanaim, right? It means two camps. Mahanaim. All right? As you can see, it's on the other side of the Jordan River. And it's in that place where Jacob wrestled, not far from there, Penuel or Peniel, was right nearby. That's where Jacob presumably wrestled with the angel. But he's there in that area because he came back, and the second place, remember we talked about the story of Jacob and the structure of that story, Okay. He begins in a place, right, that is called Mahanaim, and his major stopping place before he comes back into the country is Mahanaim. All right. So he is a person who, for whom Mahanaim was an important place. Under David, Mahanaim pops up again. Number one, one of Absalom's sons who wants to become the king. Mephibosheth was, it's Ishbal, wants to become the king. And he announces his monarchy from Mahanaim. And David, of course, that's all shut down. And then when David runs away from Avshalom, where does he go? Mahanaim. And those are the only two major, and the name is mentioned occasionally elsewhere, but by and large, the focal point on Mahanaim occurs in the lives of only Jacob and David. Okay, and it's outside, it's a point outside of the normative boundaries of Canaan or Eretz Yisrael. But nonetheless, it played an important point in each of their lives. And that's fascinating. That's a little tiny detail that could be easily overlooked. But whoever, you know, put this whole stuff together, it was brilliant. It's brilliant. And it's there that David regroups and proceeds back in order to confront Absalom. And it is from there that Jacob regroups and goes off to confront Esav. Interesting. And of course, they are both, the common denominator between Esav and Absalom is that they are blood relatives of our heroes, right? Okay, so there you have it. Okay, and I think I got one more. I talked about this already. So those are the only two people, other than Moses, the only two people in the Bible who have something to say about on their deathbed and actually address them specifically to his children in one form or another. David, on his instructions to Solomon, very limited, focused, who's a good guy, who's a bad guy, honor the good guys, get rid of the bad guys. Very simple. And of course, with Jacob, it's much more complicated because there he foresees the future of his tribes. We talked about that at length. Okay. So they're the only two people. Moses, of course, has his own poem that he says, but that's more of a general, you know, prophecy of the people. It's not meant specifically for family members. Here, both Jacob and David focus on family members. Okay? And they're the only ones. Now, as I say, there are a number of other ones that I do not have on this list. They're all noted in the literature. And it's some of them very subtle, even more subtle than some of the things you saw here. But it results in a very, very interesting. Now, the reason why, did we study the theme of in the image of God?
I don't think so. Or not?
I skipped that. Okay.
Is that for after Pesach?
Yeah, yeah.
You did the two creation stories.
That's it. Yeah, that was it. Right. And then the flood story. Right? Yeah. All right. No, so what I want to teach, where are we timers? Oh, all right. Maybe we'll end a little early. Would you mind? I know it's so much wonderful time spent together. Anyway, but the interesting thing I want to deal with afterwards is this will be very involving. It's not something we're going to jump out of quickly, but the whole use of Tzelem Elohim, the image of God, which came to be, of course, a very significant theological moral principle in Judaism, in normative, you know, traditional Judaism, human beings created in the image of God. This is something that Christianity took over lock, stock, and barrel. God bless them, you know. And this is an important thing. what is the whole purpose of the study is, what does it mean in context? And so, and how did it get blown out of proportion? And what does it mean in terms of an understanding of the nature of God? Okay, because it's not only, it's interesting, wrapped up into that, into the study is going to be, what's the nature of the human being? And what is the nature of God? And you get an insight here into the whole issue of how to understand what God is, or how people back then tried to understand what God is and what God is not. So that's the one thing. The long thing, it's going to take probably the entire balance of the class, is going to be what I call Vita Moises. That's Latin. Can somebody guess what that means in English translation?
The life of Moses.
Oh, wonderful. Our Latin scholar, Tybel, one more time, comes through. Yes. Yeah. No, I've been working on this for a long time. There have been a gazillion books written on it, but I've got some different perspectives on it. And it's fascinating, because the one thing you'll see, the reason why I use this in this class, is because you really get to see an insight into how many different streams of tradition, both internal and external, flow through the Torah accounts and ultimately into the whole Bible. It's fascinating. If I'm right, it is really fascinating.
Given the sheer period of time that all this was put together, it's very understandable. I mean, yes. I think of it kind of like a challah, you know, a braided challah, but that just has like two or three strands.
Right. And they're all woven together.
Right. But this is, at least to me, what a friend of mine called the Jewish enterprise. And the Jewish enterprise is our, if you want, our dialogue with God, is our study for thousands of years, is putting all of these pieces together. You know,
yeah. No, exactly.
And part of right before the Shema, when we talk about God loving us, part of God's love for us is in giving us Torah to be able to study it.
Yes, right. Exactly. You hear the phone ringing? I'm not going to answer it. The other thing is, though, what comes of all of this is you have a sense that the tradition can tolerate various levels of interpretation. Sort of the same thing you're saying, right? And there are red lines. There are red lines. But as you can tell from the sources that we're going to look at and what we've looked at already, there's a lot of space within those lines, right? There's a lot of space. And that means that people should be a little bit more open-minded in terms of what we perceive as legitimate or authentic perceptions of what Judaism is. There are basic, we're going to have, there has to be common denominators. There's no question.
There have been various attempts to do that over the years.
No, but I mean, the point is, the notion that certain basic things be just categorically dismissed or become categorically dominant,
right.
Okay? Like a vehement messianic approach can become very destructive. And it has been destructive for Jewish communities throughout time. There's no question about that.
Look at Maimonides' 13 principles, you know, who is trying to say what's in and what's out. But even today, I'm not sure most modern Jews would accept all 13 of them.
Right. Well, look, even in his own few generations later, the Spanish philosopher, 16th century, 15th century Jewish philosopher.
Caro?
Huh?
Shulchan Aruch, we'll be talking.
No. That's 15th century Spain, early 1400s. Oh, God. He comes up with four.
Oh, right.
Not 13, four. I mean, you know, but the point is, so there's certain basic.
Is it Joseph Albo?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Oh, that's good. Exactly. Okay.
Well, I guess there's a difference between, on the one hand, I mean, because you have Hillel and you have Micah, you know, who are, Micah was three, I guess, but that wasn't what it is to be Jewish. That was what it is, what God expects of us. And those are not necessarily the same things.
Well, I think that became clear ultimately in the what happened with the acceptance and denial of Christianity. Mm. Okay. But even the people who were Jesus followers, but remained, saw themselves as Jews, about whom we know very little, but we know they were there, right? The James line, okay, as opposed to the, let's say, Paul line, were much more traditional. They mentioned circumcision and kashrut as being foundational. In their eyes, these things were normative. Yet it was Paul who wanted to go big time, you know, and I understand why. He was a man of deep faith. I'm not, you know, I disagree with his interpretation of scripture, obviously, but he was a man of deep commitment. And he believed that he had a mission to do because he believed he saw Jesus told him to. Okay. But the point is, these other people did, but they were overwhelmed ultimately. First of all, by their geographic location and the fact they identified with the people that were known for being a rebellious people. A lot of stuff was playing against them. Okay. Whereas what Paul decided to emphasize when he took his teachings out to the world was an approach that was much more amenable to the pagan mindset and that really spoke to their needs, while at the same time not requiring that they convert, you know, to a specific national religion. We view Judaism as a universal religion, ultimately, with a natural base. But other people looked upon, in other words, we don't require people. My point is, our message ultimately is be monotheistic, world. You don't have to be Jewish. Be monotheistic. That's our message. That's our message. Okay? That's why God has a covenant with everybody. But the point is that when you start to define a religion by its nationalistic perspective, and especially you can realize that Jews in the world were becoming less enamored of the pagan world because of what happened in 70 and then again in 135. You know, so it's as if Judaism was really being drawn in at a time when Paul was taking Jewish principles and expanding their accessibility to the whole world. And so that, you know, it ended up that Judaism had to define itself very clearly as to, you know, constantly focus on what it is that unites us. What are we as opposed to the they? Okay. And so, yes, it narrows the scope, but it creates a sort of set of standards that allows, the point is, Judaism, again, it's a fine balance, and this is one of our problems. When you try to maintain a balanced situation, you know, you're always you're exposed to the power of clear feelings at the extreme. Okay? So if you say Judaism is the national religion of the Jewish people, period, we are the people that God has chosen. We are the most, we have got to be the dominant force. Something like that. Okay. You hear those words now in Israel, right now. They're being spoken. Okay. And so it's not gone. All right. On the other hand, those who say, no, we are universalistic. There's no difference between us and other, you know, monotheistic traditions. It doesn't matter if you're a good Jew, be a good person. Very commonly said by Jews. Okay. Okay, that's the problem at the extremes. Okay, but we'll talk more about this, though, as we continue. Yes, Tybel, and then we can stop. And then
two things I just wanted to say, that even when Paul or whoever it was walked away from requiring physical circumcision, it was grounded in the text, in the Devarim proof text that talked about circumcision of the heart.
Right.
And then that was enough.
Yes.
No, but my point is, didn't totally toss it out. It had to reframe it. I mean, Rabbi Halacha does that. It was in a way a halachic process, even if the outcome would be rejected. Not that I'm saying that's what Orthodox say about conservative halacha. Okay, ignore that. Take that off the tape, Bert.
Well, that's part of the problem, too. Well, I'm saying the Orthodox world needs to understand that there's a lot of space between the red lines. Okay, the modern Orthodox are more sensitive to that, I must say. It's the more extremes in Orthodoxy that wrap it more in the, you know, in the more narrow interpretations that concerns me. Mark.
Yeah, so, the conception that we're created in the image of God sort of provoked a thought in me. I mean, God is theoretically and practically involved in every human being's life on some level or another, and is sort of like tracking, you know, one's conscience and one's behavior. And that almost would necessitate like a supercomputer to be able to operate on that level with such big data being tracked. And we're doing the same as humanity. You know, we're creating methods of following people and categorizing people and looking at their health and their blood through supercomputers. And, you know, the way the Torah was redacted with all these incredible connections made, that was ingenious too without computers. They must have had quite a big staff of people finding these connections and working on them.
Remember, yes, that's an interesting observation. Remember what I told you. The guy who put together the first biblical concordance, when he finished, went crazy.
because he was finished, or he was put through this ordeal?
Brain, nobody knows. They didn't know about brain surgery. They didn't have neurology then. It was in the 19th century. The workings of the brain, you know, were just, it's only now we're beginning to understand more about that. And even there, we're still just scratching the surface, so to speak. Concordance, thank you, yes. Anyway, that's her new background. All right, the point is, yes, it is, of course, that's you're right. But I think the thing that we need to do, maybe I don't say do better at, but be recognizing is because of this complexity, we've got to be able to come to a gist of a broader agreement on, you know, where are the red lines? You know, and I mean, represent or, you know, preserve red lines that on the one hand can define what we are, but on the other hand, that do not represent a denial of the basic principles upon which we base our lives. Principles that have been modified, adjusted, and redacted over a period of time. In other words, we can't take Deuteronomy chapter 25 validates slavery, the enslavement of Canaanite slaves. It says no one can enslave an Israelite because Israelites are my servants, period. Okay? No one. And in chapter 26, God says, as he went part of the blessings before the curses, God says, and you have no slaves, meaning no Israelite slaves, but you can have pagan slaves. They are property, and you can transmit them to your children. That's in the Torah. It's there. All right? Is that a principle that we want to abide by? No. Of course not. Of course not. But it's there. What God said. How do you deal with that? If you're, how, you know.
Well, there's a lot of stuff in the Torah.
The Orthodox response is slavery doesn't exist in the world anymore. So therefore, we don't have to read those. It's there. It's what you call halakha v'morin kain. It's the law, but we don't use it. because it's irrelevant. Well, we know it's not irrelevant because slavery has been redefined somewhat today. And the fact is that there's no way we can justify it today. Slavery is still in existence. Different, takes on a different robe, but it's there. Okay. And technically, I told you there were rabbis in the 19th century as far north as Baltimore who were saying,
mm-hmm.
you can enslave the blacks because there's this thing called, you know, the curse that fell upon the curse of
Ham, right? The curse that fell on Ham.
Curse of Ham, right. In with Noah when he falls asleep, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And he gets drunk by that story. Okay. And so therefore it's legitimate. The Orthodox rabbis in the 19th century, in the face of the beginnings of the Reformation, of the freedom of the slaves, argued against it. Okay. Technically it's there. That's something we don't want to aspire to. Okay. We argue back and forth over the appropriate nature of capital punishment. You can make a good case the rabbis did not look with favor on capital punishment. Read the Talmud, read the Mishnah. It's clear. It comes right out of there. Okay? But on the other hand, people say, yeah, but that was back then when they couldn't anyway because the Romans didn't allow them to. And they would bring down the wrath of the Roman Empire upon them if they did it. So we don't do it. We can't do it. Well, we know later on they were doing it occasionally here and there. So it was around. So what do you think about that one? Not now. I'm not going to discuss it. It's not on our agenda. But the point is, there, that's an issue. Our views have changed. The whole role of women, the whole principle of egalitarianism, my whole bugaboo, patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's my whole addendum that I wrote, the paper I wrote. Is
mm-hmm.
patriarchy, out, goodbye. Excise it from our tradition is what I said. Shouldn't be there. Okay, it's there. So, I mean, these are issues that we have to have an agreement upon as red lines. Okay? So, I mean, and others. It can be done. All right. Okay. I see all the hands that went away. This is good. It's time for me to stop talking. And it's time for us to end our class. Guys, it's been a blast.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcasts site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am, Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.